This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, Ole Domegaard, who is an expert on assassinations and assassins and someone in whom I have enormous confidence. Ole and I have for some time now been discussing a series of interviews I've done with a woman from Toronto who grew up with a crime family there. It's a very complicated case. Her name is Haley Otis, and the individual she implicates in a series of crime include Clyde Forshaw, his son Alfred, another son, and a cousin by the name of Walter Tobinski, who may have been the individual who was photographed outside the Cuban embassy in Mexico City, impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald. That gives you some indication of the depth of all this. I have recently heard from Haley after a three-month interval during which, frankly, I believed that she had been taken out, but which included a rather uncharacteristic and direct threat to me, which has obligated me to make this public so the everyone will be aware of what's going on, and should something unfortunate befall me or my family, there will be a lot of reason to believe that the source was the subject of this conversation today and of our past many discussions where I featured her previously on the 26th December 2012, if I recall the date exactly, with an article entitled Bank Robbers and Serial Killers, as CIA Hires Them, FBI Ignores Them, which everyone ought to read. I mean, this is just such a really complicated case, and there's so much information, and so difficult to confirm what is true and what is false. But I must say that over the many years I've had conversation with Haley, Ole. I have found her story to be incredibly detailed, complex, and coherent, where I believe she must have a photographic memory, because otherwise I cannot imagine how she could possibly go back and forth, dates, times, persons, murders, the way it was done, and so forth, over and over again for this prolonged period of time. I'm so pleased to have you here for us to have the opportunity to discuss this, Ole. I'm very interested to begin by, you know, inviting your general impression of the situation.
Thank you so much, Tim. The pleasure is absolutely mine. And I totally agree. I have very great respect for Haley Otis, her enormous courage and her incredible memory as well. I think that what she's come forward with are so many historical, very, very important details that have not been uncovered before. I do not always agree with her when it comes to conclusions of some events and so on. But I mean, we're all trying to put together this enormous jigsaw. So I'm welcoming everyone who can bring something forward to see what the best way to get the whole thing together. But I truly believe in a lot of what she's saying as well. I do not feel that she's been lying on a single point at all.
Yeah, and it's all profoundly disturbing. And I'm gonna actually play the last conversation we had for the second segment, so everyone can understand what we're talking about and why I have felt as though I could no longer hold back in public discussion of these issues, which have so many ramifications. Ole, you've been ahead of me in the sense of mentioning some of the key players here on other interviews you have done. I'd be very interested in how you have integrated them into the broader scheme of things, perhaps especially with regard to JFK, but where they may have been involved in a very large number of other murders and assassinations, including possibly, according to Haley, even those of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy as well, and much later, of course, the death of John Kennedy Jr.
And also John Lennon, she's mentioned him as well. So no, it's absolutely incredible. And what she's talking about is that a person like Clive Forshaw has about 1,000 people on his list of killings. So it's an incredible scandal we're talking about here, because apparently, since she's been trying to get this solved and she's approached the authorities so many times over so many years, and it's just been a total cover-up. Nobody has reacted, nobody has helped her, nobody has put her on a witness protection program, nothing. She's just been, instead of being helped, she's been threatened, and even they tried to kill her even, so it's a super
before
scandal.
Before this last phone call, which occurred a week before last Friday, she told me that someone had taken a shot at her as she was about to get into a bus, and that the bus driver wanted her to call the police, but she said no, you know, she knew what was going on and hastened home, and I think it was after that then that she called me. She has observed, you know, I mean, among the, you pointed out about the authorities, went back in December when I believe she had been killed, I made an effort to contact multiple authorities, including the Toronto Police, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, because she could give me information about a series of bank robbers, including Clyde Forshaw, who subsequently appears to have been, if what Haley is telling us is correct, to have knocked off a series of ATMs with his son Alfred, who is an attorney. I mean, this is a really amazing case that he has, you know, he served as a trolley conductor in Toronto and actually murdered some of those who were aboard his trolley car when they saw something that they shouldn't have seen. I mean, Haley has told me how she has gone to the cold case, you know, officer there in Toronto, and he's explained, what did she want to do, put him out of business? Because there's so many cold cases about which he has very specific and detailed information, and she is telling me that one of the reasons why the authorities do not want to pursue this, even though this man remains a a huge threat to the public safety is because of the massive liability suits that would be generated by the realization that the authorities knew he had been committing these crimes and did nothing to stop it. I even called the FBI. I spoke with several FBI officials. I eventually came into contact with a U.S. attorney here in Madison. And I got to say, Ole, I've been absolutely dumbfounded that none of them have raised their least digit to do anything appropriate in response to the information I was providing them. And those who want substantiation of what I'm saying should go to Bank Robbers and Serial Killers on Veterans Today, because I embedded many of my previous conversations with Haley in that article.
Yeah, I don't know what to add, except for that if she had been a crazy person, they would have just been dealing with her in a totally different way. Now, instead, they just totally neglected her, have not. It's just been the lock on, the lid on, cover up all the time. So that she's been able, for one thing, that she has survived all these years, that's incredible in itself. But also, it's very important to see she has absolutely no gain, personal gain, from exposing this. The only thing that she has expressed is that she wants the families of all of these victims to get closure, to find out what actually happened to their loved ones.
Yes.
And to stop this whole thing. And this is where,
yes,
I have decided to put myself on the line as well and go out public with these names like Clyde Forshaw and Walter Tobinski. I've done that. I've handpicked the platforms on some very high-level radio programs with thousands and thousands and thousands of listeners to be sure to get it out there very quickly, so that, just like you say, if something should happen to me or one of my dear ones, and so that it would only confirm what I claimed, and also that people would understand where it came from. I would also say, just I think I can speak for you as well, Jim. We are not depressed. None of us suicidal. Our cars are working fine, and so on. You know, no depression or any ideas of ending our lives ourselves. So it is just so important for both of us to reveal this, to stop this incredible madness that has been going around for so many years around these big cases, and where this is one of the core themes, where these two individuals and Haley's brother have been the core members of like a death squad that have been part of cleaning up after these major assassinations.
It's stunning, Ole. It's absolutely stunning, and that those authorities that I contacted, including the FBI, which I thought would, you know, given that, of course, what she's told me about their potential involvement in the assassination of JFK, Martin, Bobby, and John Kennedy Jr., and even, as you mentioned, possibly having to do with John Lennon, I knew that would be so difficult for them to swallow that I thought the more obvious case of the bank robberies, where Haley has identified this person known as the Geezer Bandit or as the Vaulter or Vaulting Bandit, where I have photographs that were included in the article, would give them more than sufficient justification to go forward with this. I have shared it, this information, these interviews and conversations I have done with Haley over the years, with quite a few experts on the assassination around the world, I would say. And the fact is that, you know, the officials have done nothing about it to me. Led one of them, who's very well positioned, to suggest that they're protected, that because of their involvement in the assassination of JFK, they may be able to pull off any crime they want whatsoever, you know, murders, robberies, ATM knockoffs, who knows what, where the number of those involved appears staggering. I mean, you mentioned, and Haley has said, that he may have murdered 1,000 people. Well, if Clyde Forshaw has murdered 1,000 people, that makes him perhaps the greatest serial killer in world history. In world history. And yet the FBI and the Toronto Police and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police are unwilling to do anything about it. I find this completely outrageous, Ole. And when Haley conveys to me this very explicit threat, which everyone will hear during the second segment, it seemed to me the time had come to go public with all of this, because the world deserves to know, and especially, it seems to me, the population of Toronto, that there's a man who, of whom the police are aware, has committed many, many murders, and yet they allow him to serve as an official by conducting a trolley, a public trolley, in relation to which he, if what Haley is telling me is accurate, has murdered several of those who were actually on the trolley, but innumerable other citizens of Toronto. I mean, it's a staggering assortment of killings, many of which are especially brutal, vicious, sadistic. I mean, this is an appalling case, Oli, and I just am dumbfounded at the complete and utter failure of duly appointed officials to take appropriate measures to deal with it.
I can only agree. And this thing that he's been driving this streetcar and trolley and buses up and down the streets of Toronto over all of these years, since the early 1960s and all the way up until, as far as I know today, just being such a threat to normal people without people. He's even used this as a cover, being able to get away with many of these murders. And we're talking murders of everything from children to women to innocent to and creating patsies. Many people have been put away innocently for many of these murders that they have committed, where they on purpose have created like evidence to put them away as patsies into mental institution or prisons and so on. So it's an like you say, I think it's one of the biggest scandal in modern time. If when this gets uncovered in its true nature and pure detail, it was just a scandal that unheard of.
It defies belief. It defies belief. And there are the Canadian authorities fully knowledgeable about this and yet nevertheless taking no action whatsoever. As you observe, he appears to be a brilliant criminal mind, that he uses many disguises, that he's able to plant evidence, including DNA evidence, so he'll obtain samples of semen from prostitutes that he then, you know, disposes at a crime scene to implicate someone else. I mean, the police, after all, discovering a sample of semen at a scene where a woman is murdered and raped or otherwise abused is going to take for granted that that was the perp, not beginning to imagine the depths of depravity, the skill at deception that this man is capable of orchestrating, where he even... Haley described to me one particularly vicious murder of a woman who owned a jewelry store, and where he was butchering her slowly. I mean, he was taking great pleasure in his sadistic practice, and while he was in the process of murdering her, someone came to the jewelry store, the door of which was closed and locked, and knocked, and he went to the door. You know, and calmly acted as though he should be there, and explained that she was gone, but she'd be back if they came back later, and then proceeded back to the victim, who was just whimpering, you know, reduced to mere whimpering, and split her skull with an axe. I mean, you know, this is the most disgusting history I have ever heard, and it's been, you know, driving me crazy, because I felt to protect Haley that I really ought not to be talking about it. I published the earlier piece, Bank Robbers and Serial Killers, when I believe she was already dead. And up until 3 months ago, you know, I had thought she was doing okay. And then it was, let's see, the 22nd. I was in Santa Barbara on the 22nd for the JFK. Saturday was the 23rd. Sunday was the 24th. We were supposed to speak, but I delayed it until the 25th. Maybe even to the 26th, but on the 25th or the 26th, I was unable to reach her. And from the 26th of November until about 10 days ago, I hadn't heard from her at all. And then, you know, that Friday, I got this this call from her, including this with a very different attitude. Aren't you struck, by the way, Ole, with a difference in Haley's attitude during this particular conversation, in contrast to all the others with which you are familiar?
I've been listening to, I don't know, I think hundreds of hours, I don't know how many hours that you've been kind enough to share with me of these recorded calls, and in every single one, she's been extremely precise with details. She's been treating you with the utmost admiration and respect, and called you Professor Fetzer and this type of thing. Then in the last final call here, she's almost rude and very aggressive to you. She doesn't want to give you any details. She's just, it's like a totally, it's almost like a different person. So for sure, it's very odd. And I think maybe, I just have a theory that she might have been threatened while making this phone call, that she was doing it under a lot of pressure, and that's why it came out like this. So the reason why I'm part of this is also why we go out with this, is to try and protect Haley at this point, so that if anything happens to her, anything at all, it would be pointing straight at these people, because they are the ones that have made her life a total hell for so many years.
I was fascinated by your observation or suggestion that she might have been making the phone call with a gun pointed at her head. I must say, you know, that she's been a person running, you know, all kinds of major risk with her life by revealing this information, has been well known, so that she would come into police departments or talk with reporters or what have you, and they would say, "Haley, I can't believe you're still alive." I mean, that would be a common response to encountering her. She does have an attorney. She has been working on affidavits, of which I have no doubt that they are. Clyde Forshaw and the rest of the family are fully aware, and it's just, you know, she's really dedicated her life to trying to expose the crimes and corruptions here for the benefit of the people of Toronto, and to bring a degree of justice, you know, to the savagery he has displayed. I mean, she watched him commit his first murder when he was like 10 or 12 years old, where he stomped to death. He jumped on the chest of a little boy that had he was just eager to kill, and suffocated him by crushing him by jumping on his chest. I mean, it's simply appalling. And she's described to me multiple attempts, you know, to kill her in the past, including by Walter Tobinski, and where most recently she called me in great concern. This was about a year ago, where Clyde was following her. He was wearing oversized shoes and an unusual clothing. He'll wear mustaches, wigs, all kinds of disguises. I mean, this man is a master criminal, and I have no doubt, Ole, that if the story is ever told, he's going to go down as the most savage killer in human history. The most savage killer, the most sadistic, the most brutal, the most ruthless in all of history.
As far as she says, Walter Tobinski was, even from a very, very young age, was trained by a former SS officer. I think one of these people that was exported through Operation Paperclip, one of them being Reinhard Gehlen, who was part of building the whole Gladio network in Europe, and also was part of a lot of other atrocities during the history of the world, including murdering Nikola Tesla. And it seems like Walter Tobinski was trained, and also Clyde, from a very, very young age. Before, I think sometimes Haley has mentioned the age of four when they started to kill. They trained them to kill animals. Then when they grew a bit older, they got them to kill children. And then later on, they went for adults. It was sort of like a gradual education on into getting into this evil path. And also Walter Tobinski was one of the members in the Civil Air Patrol, where Lee Harvey Oswald was recruited very young, also as a teenager, together with Barry Seals and many other who are very... integrated with the JFK assassination, where David Ferry was one of the officers training these kids. And I just want to say, the founder of this Civil Air Patrol was a military man and also an oil tycoon by the name of Harry Byrd. And Harry Byrd was also the owner of the Texas School Book Depository, which could be quite interesting to know.
Oh, I agree completely. Yes, Byrd was a founder of this this Civil Air Patrol, and also the owner of the Book Depository, and was well familiar with Lee Oswald, David Ferry, and a host of others, is really very striking information. I think it might be time for us to take the first break, and when we return, I'm going to play the final interview I had with Haley Otis, so that everyone can hear Haley for themselves, and we'll have a much better idea of exactly what has precipitated Ole and I having this conversation with all of you today. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, Ole Damegaard. We're talking about what may be the world's greatest serial killer. We'll be right back.
Is there anybody going to listen to my story, all about the girl who came to stay? She's the kind of girl you want so much it makes you sorry, still you don't regret a single day. Oh, girl. So hard to leave her, she will turn to me and start to cry, and she promises the earth to me, and I believe her. After all this time, I don't know why. Oh, girl, 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 she's the kind of girl who puts you down when friends are there, you feel a fool. When you say she's looking good, she acts as if it's understood she's cool.
Even Bush admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it?
Who did it?
The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
Michelle, my bell, someday.
That's all I want to say. Until I find a way, I will say the only words I know that you understand. Michel, ma belle, son des mots qui vont très bien ensemble, très bien ensemble. I need to make you see, oh, what you mean to me. Until I do, I'm hoping you will know what I mean. I love you.
Honest to
God, getting back to what I was saying.
Back up a minute. I say, honest to God, I thought you were dead.
This is how serious it is, so you know what you're dealing with. James Cobblestone said, I've looked up, I saw the email, right, that was sent to you. I haven't seen that Fetzer is alive, or something like that, it says there, from James Cobblestone. I've looked up there's a person by the name of James Fetzer, and I found that he isn't alive, indirectly saying you're dead man. Look at that, you understand how serious these people are. Within 3 weeks, right where Clyde lives, a guy was shot through the windshield on the driver's side, about 4 blocks from where Clyde's house is. He's using the other car, which is a Honda, and it's a two-door, minus the seat in the back. That's where he puts his cadavers in. A silver Hyundai is what he normally drives, and that was a Honda. That was in about a week and a half ago, or a week ago. Within that same week, where Clyde's oldest son was working on a restaurant called Wildfire, a Chinese guy or Oriental was shot right on Yonge Street, the main drag. And all the cops said it was a brazen killing. And what did they see? A guy with blonde hair, that was Alfred, right? It's either Alfred or Clyde Jr., with spiked blonde hair with a hoodie. Right in, I can't even come out of my house. Do you understand? So you understand the severity of it.
What?
Clyde and his son, or his cousin, Walter Dubinsky, when they went to Winnipeg all the time to see this old grandmother and the whole clan, because they have part of the clan in Winnipeg, when I was saying to you why it's so important of who the Dubinskys are, where they live, one of the daughters, if you take a look on Facebook, her hobby is the AR, what is it, 12 or 15 rifle? And why would a girl...
AR-15.
Why would that be her specialty? that's Tobinsky's, one of the daughters. Anyway, so you understand. As they were going through from Detroit into Illinois and in through Wisconsin, they did the capital city murders. Do you get my drift? They did. I told you one time, Clyde said that he wanted to kill the whole Percy family. Valerie Percy, okay? The senator's daughter. She was killed, Clyde said. He killed her with a pinball, pinball hammer. And remember I told you I was chased up and down the whole house where we lived on 45 with Marlboro with a bayonet.
Why was he after senator?
The senator, the orders came from Nixon.
From Nixon?
He didn't want to go. Yeah, he did not want to go into. He did not want to go into Vietnam, Senator Percy. It was against what Nixon wanted, and he was on Nixon's enemy list or his ship list. So that's why the whole family was going to be killed. But if it hadn't been for the mother, Clyde said that he shone the flashlight right in her face, but she was able to see what he looked like. And what was the description? Short with a ruddy complexion. Need I say any more? Jesus Christ, like, no one gets my drift. He also did Linda Bricka, Gerald Bricka, and Deborah Bricka. They've linked the Percy case and the Bricka case. He also did the Robson killing, right? These are books. You have to ask yourself one hard question. I didn't like that you started getting into an antagonistic situation with Michael Collins Piper. Remember I told you I was looking up Find a Grave? Well, all the victims from the Sandy Hook are on Find a Grave. Like, what if they're dead? What if the government knows that someone like Clyde did it? They've linked the Zodiac to the Bricka murders. Look it up on the internet. Linda Bricka, Gerald Bricka, Deborah Bricker, Zodiac. And they're trying to pin it on a goddamn Ted.
Haley, no children died at Sandy Hook.
Anyway, what if they did?
They didn't. I'm telling you, they didn't.
Okay, what if they did?
The whole thing was a fucking fraud. It was a fucking fraud. They had 26 Christmas trees behind the fucking fireplace the day before. 26 fucking Christmas trees they brought out on the 15th and decorated for the 26 victims. It was in the works for 2.5 years.
Well, whatever it is, all I know is he was part of Operation Chaos. He talked about it in that confession there.
What's the story about Piper? Piper is just an asshole.
Maybe someone was killed. Maybe Adam Lanza was set up, okay? Maybe something happened. Maybe the government, the FBI put a 50-year ban to it, the same as they did to Kennedy, because they know the same person did it. In 1970, the police already knew who the Zodiac was. Why did this LAPD cop want to get, the confession out of the hitman that he went looking for all around the world? Easy enough. You just look at a friggin' phone number in the phone book, and there he is. All you have to have is the name, which I did, because no one else knows about it except me. I found my brother's friggin' picture at Dealey Plaza with Clyde right under or right in front of the Texas Book Depository. I'm not going to tell you where, but they're all in the fucking photographs. The evidence is there. The orders came from the government.
But they're in Grodin's book.
They're in Grodin's book, but I won't tell you which. I
got Grodin's book right here. I've got it open.
I'm not going to say where it is. You do the homework. Anyway, you look up what this guy, John Bickwia, is. John Bickwia started talking about, Roy Hargraves or whatever, saying that there was a circle, a jerk circle, That's what he was doing with the kid in our backyard. Whoever jerks off first gets killed. Ah, why would this guy says he's gone to Harvard, and then he talks about a circle jerk?
Ridiculous.
Take a look at all the people, the way he talks. This guy, take a look at the picture of John Bequia, right? And then take a look at this latest bank robber by the name of Bones, or Boney. B-O-N, I think E-Y or just B-O-N-Y. That's Clyde with the mustache now that looks like John Bequia. He's got a skull and bones toucan with an orange bag.
Where is that photograph?
Yeah, just,
where is that photograph?
Just put images. Let me hear. I'll look it up here. You put images of in Bing. Here, let me look it up here so you see it. I couldn't even come out. It was the first day I went out just to get a call in the car. I also got almost pleurisy. The director upstairs got me antibiotics, so I started taking them today. I couldn't even go to the pharmacist because I was that sick.
Images of what?
Images of Boney, B-O-N-E, Boney Bandit. Let me see if that's the one. I put it in the wrong spot here. Images of B-O-N, is Boney B-O-N-E-Y?
Well, it might be. I mean, I'm looking at images of Boney Bandit, and then there's nobody that looks like Clyde.
Okay, yeah, no. Yes, it is, here. Okay, put Bing as your search engine. And then you see a guy that looks like, the skeleton, before you even click in there. It has a skeleton horse and a guy with a neckerchief over his face. And
yeah, I see that. I'm looking at that.
Okay, and then you see the first one on right going,
to the left
on
of
the
it.
Top there. Yeah, and you see this guy. When you click on, you see that the toque he's wearing is got skull and bones. That's Clyde.
That's Clyde?
That's Clyde. And see what on the other side is. Bonnie and Clyde and a plane in between. Do you get my drift that this is all known by the government? They don't want this stuff to come out. What irks me now is who lives on what do you call it? You know, the death threat that you got from James Cobblestone? John Allure lives in Whitechapel, North Carolina.
I don't even know that I'm aware that I got a death threat from Cobblestone.
You got a death threat. It's there.
Where is it? It's in my email?
In your email from Alfred.
When did I get this?
I'll send it to you. It was the sense of the time when you started making these, putting this stuff out. So, you don't know what you're dealing with. You're dealing with a guy who was known as the Strangler here in Toronto, or went to Boston and did the Boston Strangling. Who do you think the first victim was? My mother's one of her best friends. She was a Latvian woman that my mother met during the, when we were sent into, not concentration camps, but, what do you call it, disposed people, because Latvians, Lithuanians, and Estonians went into various, what they called it, a DP camp.
Okay.
And my mother met the first victim. That was a woman who used to take care of me. The first Boston Strangler victim. So we got Boston Strangler. A guy's been sitting for doing the co-ed murders in Michigan. And in 1980, he appeared. His name is John Norman Collins. You know how Clyde said that he got these co-eds? Playing Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson will give you a lift. The co-eds need a lift to their, from A to B. So he's gone through your area. So you got the death threat. You put it out on the internet. I wanted to tell you, you're playing hardball with the government here that's been suppressing these cases that go on and on from the, what do you call it, Boston Strangler, the Zodiac. They've linked it in. They've got the friggin' DNA. They've known who the Zodiac is from 1970. And they try to pin it on some sucker again. This goes on and on. Anyway, if you just look on the video of John Norman Collins, after you see it, you see this guy is not going to be let out for the rest of his life.
Wait a
minute. He was convicted on one of the co-ed murders.
What's his name again? John?
John Norman Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S.
There's a whole bunch of YouTubes about him.
Okay. Now, when I looked at these things, remember I told you he put in that little Carol voice that they pinned it, or Clyde had this guy set up by the name of Peter Woodcock, who's now dead? What I found is there's a whole encyclopedia of cases where they've set up a patsy, right? There's so many cases where the person said, I didn't do it, and he goes through the whole rotten system. And before, you know, there was no DNA, and then all of a sudden, the DNA said it wasn't him. Well, guess what? Guess what? They did homicides all over the United States, because how many people were killed because of Kennedy that they had to get rid of, other than,
I thought a lot of them were done by Roscoe White.
Roscoe White fucking Schmite. It was done by none other than the biggest killer of all, Clyde and his cousin, Walter Dubinsky. They were the ones that, like, I'll say again, who was Hoover talking to the next day with that fat ass Johnson? That's what was on their lips. Dubinsky. That's the most important thing. And these guys are laughing. So that's why when he says Zodiac, he's done all these things and he moves into another area. It's like cluster murders, whether it's, you know, Arizona or California or Ohio, all of these unsolved murders. Who do you think this goddamn son of his? He had one son. You know what the guy has? A shipping business. Easy to do murders along the highway routes, right? Jesus
Christ, You mean like a trucking business?
That's right. Easy to bring in, dope and whatnot. They were the French Connection, I said before. This is heavy drugs. And he said in his confession that he was sent into Central America to kill I don't know how many people as a paid mercenary, so they didn't have this immigration problem of Guatemalans and Nicaraguans here in America. That's all part of the Iran-Contra situation with the Ollie North. They don't want this shit to come out. That's why he can indiscriminately. And then you're talking to a guy, Alfred, who's already done 20 people, murdered 20. You're having a conversation with a serial killer.
When did I have a conversation with him?
On the internet, when you're emailing, hey, Alfred, you're going to be incarcerated or.
You mean way back when I published Bank Robbers and Serial Killers?
Yeah.
That was
right.
A fucking long time ago, Haley.
That's a year ago, but don't think that they're not going to. Like Clyde said one day, I take my time. I don't forget. And I'm a very patient man. So when you go on there, you've endangered your whole family. If he's gone and done home invasions, that they have the DNA of who.
What do you mean? When I published that article? When I published that article?
Yeah.
Haley, I published it because I thought you were dead, for God's sake. I was honoring you, for God's sake, by publishing that.
Oh, that I was going to stay alive. Your whole family will be at some point. He can get anyone at any time with a sniper rifle. Any time. But like I said, the Capital City murders that are unsolved in Wisconsin is done by him. Easy pickings.
The Capital City Murders, right here in Madison?
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Like, wake up. Why do you think your wife got all upset? What, you're stepping on people's toes that are organized crime, murders, you know, of the highest order. Who understood, you know, where I was coming from was Galen Ross. The elite serial killers. They're not just serial killers. They're murder for hire from the government, and the government's protecting. Why isn't the Zodiac case been solved? Why isn't the co-ed murders been resolved? Why isn't the Bricka case resolved? Why isn't the Percy case resolved? Why isn't the Robinson case resolved? Why isn't the Sims case, solved? Now, the Trace the Allure case is very important because John Allure, who lives now not in Quebec, he lives in Whitechapel in North Carolina. He took a private investigator to unravel this, not a cop, because the cop got rid of his sister's underwear that the DNA was on. You know, Clyde's DNA. I took a photograph of the daughter, the Teresa Allure, because Clyde showed it to me along with Sharon Pryor, because I said, oh, is she ever a lovely-looking girl? Who is she? Clyde says, oh, that's my third wife. I said, that doesn't look like your third wife. So one day when Clyde went to the dentist, I photographed these girls. He takes their wallet and he takes their photograph out of the wallet as a souvenir. So I just wanted to, you know, to tell you, you tread on heavy shit, and you better tell your family and be upfront about it, because they have to be warned, you know, what you did in putting that on the internet. This is covered up from the government up. You know, these are the people that made the money with the Vietnam War and who wanted it. From Nixon on who made money with the whole thing. But he went after people, you know, from the Hughes, the family also killed Bowles, B-O-L-E-S, on and on, home invasions. So I was thinking, how easy for Clyde to find where you live, to surveil it and how they get in and do a home invasion. Do you have security? Probably not in the highest order. So anyway, I just wanted, after I found it, oh my God, here is Fetzer, and he's talking to a kid who's already killed 20 plus. Huh?
But I don't like
the way you're talking about my family. I saw the in between emails. Anyway, I don't want to talk about this anymore. I'm going to try to stay alive and do what my business. You do your business, but don't start raising flack of every person, anyone you meet, if you don't meet their. The other thing that I wanted to say, if this, you know, what the conversation I had with Nelson, I says, Nelson, you know, 9/11 was the biggest fucking bank heist of all. How did you guess that, Haley? I said, well, what the fuck were all these Brinks trucks coming there and bringing out the gold at the bottom there? Now, if there was a nuclear problem or all this heavy, heavy molten lava, they wouldn't have allowed the Brinks trucks. This is the gold from the Second World War that was taken away from underneath there. Where did the fucking Jews sit on? Is there gold right on top of it? That's what the whole thing was all about. And one guy was right on the ball that sent you an email. Why would Wall Street boys shit in their own nest and have a nuclear contamination? Why would they build another scraper on nuclear contamination?
They weren't able to build it. They put in two pools instead.
Yeah, whatever they did, no one would go there. You know, the whole thing is, it's all full of shit. The whole thing is, it was a big heist, the biggest gold heist that ever was. Take a look in the old newspapers.
Well, how do you think it was done if it wasn't done with nukes? I published a half a dozen articles.
No. Like, when I started seeing that, you're starting to raise black about here, they could have easily done it with these very, like I said, with the, you know, dynamite or whatever.
When I went
to this stupid Hilton hotel, I paid stupidly $250 a night. At 6 o'clock in the morning, they had to peel me off the ceiling because they just detonated a building beside. These skyscrapers are built now, the new ones, already with the explosives inside. So if at any particular time they want to take it down, they do. And they said this is a common occurrence here in Manhattan. So, you know, don't be scared. I said, well, I want my money back. I don't want to be wakened up, you know, thinking the end of the world is here. Well, do you think the friggin' Hilton Hotel would reimburse me?
When was this?
I don't know, in 89 or 90 or whatever. All of these buildings are built with this shit.
I'm just kind of floored by your change in attitude. You've never had this attitude before.
No, it's because when I saw when you're starting to do dialogue with Alfred, and when I was in that goddamn coffee shop sweating bullets when I saw Clyde, you called Alfred and said, "Well, I'm just Haley's just seeing Clyde. You're putting my fucking life on the line. What the fuck for?"
Haley, this is over a fucking year ago. What the fuck are you coming up with this now?
Because I want to tell you, you're threading on really serious stuff.
I figured that out a long fucking time ago, Haley.
Yeah, but anyway,
I've gone out of my way to try to protect you, goddammit.
What? Why? For calling me and then putting this on the internet? Now I can't even come out of my apartment?
Good God, I did
that. How are you doing me a service?
We have had, you know, we have had 50 talks.
Anyway, don't ever call me again. I wanted to say, be very protective of your family and alert, because you went in there where the whole government has protected these mercenaries, and they've been alive for years, and they don't intend to open this can of worms up any time soon because of the liability of it. It would cause a revolution.
Okay.
It's heavy stuff.
Thanks, Haley.
But anyway,
that's all I
wanted to say.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
I told you about strawberry peels. You know the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go. Thank you.
We can now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Baby's good to me, you know she's happy as can be, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. Baby says she's mine, you know she tells me all the time, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. I'm so glad that she's my little girl. She's so glad she's telling all the world. He buys her diamond rings, you know she said so. She's in love with me and I feel fine. She's mine, you know she tells me all the time, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. I'm so glad that she's my little girl. She's so glad she's telling all the world that her baby buys her things, you know. He buys her diamond rings, you know she said so. She's in love with me and I feel fine. She's in love with me and I feel fine.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Continuing my conversation with Ole Domegaard, now that everyone has heard that final conversation I had with Haley Otis. Ole, I'm really fascinated, you know, in your take about how all this information she's provided us fits into the big picture, you know, any aspect of it, including, of course, the assassination of JFK, where I know you believe that she's offered us an explanation that covers some heretofore unsuspected or unknown aspects. I mean, I've been struck by the fact that the individual who was photographed by the CIA outside of the Cuban embassy looked nothing like Lee Harvey Oswald. He's a big guy. I'd say he might even be as big as 6'2". He's got a crew cut. He must weigh well over, 200 pounds. Lee Oswald was about 5'10 and weighed about, 130 pounds. I mean, he was, and he had a very slender build. I mean, these are completely different people. I have long maintained that if all you knew was that the person who was photographed outside of the Cuban embassy was not Lee Oswald, You would know enough to conclude that this had been a conspiracy, where in fact J. Edgar Hoover actually sent a memorandum to all of his agents in charge explaining that someone was in Mexico City impersonating Lee Oswald. And yet, you know, how anyone in the face of even that elementary point could continue to believe that Lee Oswald was the lone demented assassin of Lee Oswald speaks to me of some degree of cognitive impairment or virtually willing gullibility.
I tell you, I think it's to understand what's going on. I think it's very, very important to have a closer look at what was called Operation 40. Is it okay if I go into some detail?
I wish you would. Yes.
Okay. In the early 1960s, Dwight Eisenhower, the president, gave his vice president Richard Nixon, together with Alan Dulles, the task to form a special team of assassins that could be used internationally. And also on any different area, wherever they had problems with a politician, a dictator, whoever they wanted to get rid of. So what they did was that they put together a team from the CIA. It was people like David Attlee Phillips, who was the station chief in Mexico City. He was also the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the controller of James Files, who is a man that is considered to be a possible shooter from behind the picket fence. He was also the controller of a man called Michael Van Townley, who was later very close, connected to Operation 40, and many years later part of taking out the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, 1986. Anyway, this David Attlee Phillips, he had also colleagues like Ted Shackley, the blonde ghost, who was also super, super involved in assassinations all over the globe. David Attlee Phillips, he later became the chief director of covert operation for the Western Hemisphere. So, I mean, we're not talking about amateurs here. We're talking high-level people. And also another CIA operative that was part of this was Howard Hughes. E. Howard Hunt, sorry about that. E. Howard Hunt. One of the Watergate burglars and also central in the JFK assassination and many, many, many other assassinations. But this group of assassins were most of them were recruited from the Exil-Cuban community in Miami and so on. And you will find that these assassins have been used, in my humble opinion, I've been able to track them down to so, so many of these assassinations that have been going on since the early 1960s all the way up until almost today. I mean, they're getting old, these guys, but they're still active, some of them. And in this group, also closely associated with them, I would suggest that Clyde Forshaw and Walter Tobinski have been since the late 1950s, early 1960s, and all the way up until today, involved in countless number of atrocity and assassinations on behalf of the CIA, but also the mob and other governmental things. Wherever they needed someone to be cleaned out, they used these people because they, just like you say, Jim, these people have been extremely skilled and extremely successful in covering up and hiding and so on. So people like you and I who have spent like 3 decades looking into these things, I had no idea about the identity of these two before Haley came forward. Absolutely not. I was just, there was just one massive big question mark around who killed all the witnesses? Who killed all of these people that there was? I mean, there's a list of hundreds of people around the JFK assassination that have been terminated, as they so beautifully call it, and so on. And I've always been wondering who have been doing these. And then, of course, when Haley came forward, then suddenly it all makes sense.
Yes.
So... No, I would also suggest that I would like maybe in another program to get in very great detail about what happened around Dealey Plaza, because it's a very intricate and very, very complex
Ollie, thing you're that welcome happens. To you're welcome to give us a sketch right now. I mean, I think that it's very appropriate. So please do. You know, proceed. I mean, I'll be glad to have you back again and again. Believe me.
Okay, thank you, Jim. No, it's just that it's very time consuming, but if we go back to Walter and Clyde, because there were several shooting teams or shooters around Dealey Plaza. According to me, there were multiple shooters in many different positions, not all of them shooting and some of them shooting with silencers. But there were a lot of shooters around Dealey Plaza this day because there was also more than one operation going on, which makes the whole, this is part of, it's almost like standard in this template when they carry out assassinations, that there are more than one plan being carried out, more than one team at the location and so on, purposely put there to create confusion for someone like myself when you start looking into it. But the people that
any group or individuals who actually sought to solve the crime, as you well know, I have specified or identified shooters at six different locations who appear to have been representatives of the different groups involved, including Harry Weatherford, a deputy sheriff at the top of the county records, billing Jack Lawrence, an Air Force expert from the south side of the Triple Underpass, Roscoe White, who was a Dallas policeman tied into the CIA from the Grassy Knoll, Frank Sturgis from the north end of the Triple Underpass, who was tied in with a Meyer Lansky crime syndicate in the CIA, Nestor Tony Escadro, who was in the Daltex and whom I believe was firing the only unsilenced weapon, namely a Mandeker Carcano, under the supervision of George H.W. Bush, and then finally, Malcolm Mack Wallace, Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman, who murdered a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters, from the book depository, firing at John Connolly in the mistaken belief that it was Ralph Yarborough, but where no shots at all were fired from the sixth floor of the book depository, the alleged assassin's lair, and Lee Oswald was actually in the doorway where he was captured in a famous photograph by James Ike Alchins. Now, I realize full well that you and I have some differences about the shooters and their locations, but I just wanted to say how much we're in agreement in general about what was going on with multiple shooters, where by my account, 8, 9, or 10 shots were fired and JFK was hit at least 4 different times.
Yeah, just like you say, we don't really agree on who did what this day, but we certainly agree on that there were multiple shooters and they were just all over the place. And I think when you see the whole structure, you will also see that this was a school example of how to carry out an assassination on a high level. And also, if you look at there are four, except for Abraham Zapruder, there are four people in dark suits, white shirt and a tie that are filming exactly when the headshot are being fired. They're within 15 meters from the limo, two on each side of the Grassy Knoll, filming the limo scene. I mean, the whole thing is just set as an ambush, filmed ambush that can be used as a snuff film or education or whatever. But I think one of the important things to understand also is that officially the motorcade would go straight down Main Street towards the Trademark Center where he was supposed to give a speech this day. So everyone who's around the corner, like Main Street goes straight west, then you have first the motorcade turn right on down on Houston, and then this deadly turn around 120 degrees down on Elm Street, where the shooting started. But that means that normal people that have been reading the newspaper and so on, they would have been standing next to Main Street, and people who knew about what was going on, many of them would have been gathered around Houston Street and Elm Street. So I think it's really interesting to see how many of these individuals, when you start identifying them, it's incredible the amount of people that were there this day. And some of the shooters, or people who have admitted to being there, they said it was like an old boys' home. I mean, there were assassins all over the place. And what I've spent years on is trying to track down who was actually there, how did they get there, what different vehicles were used, what different escape cars and so on. How did they come to Dallas? Where did they hide? Where were the safe houses and so on? And I just want to say the reason why at least I am so focused on this crime is not that a president was murdered in 1963, because that could be a tragic event, but case closed and let's move forward. The reason I think it's so important to really, really track down and understand what happened was that, in my humble opinion, the same power elite that took out, that slaughtered JFK this day, is the same power elite that is still in the White House and other places ruling our lives, trying to force it into this dark, controlled, awful place. So by exposing these old crimes, you will also expose the people that are still in running this show. Not very long, I hope. So
I think you're absolutely right. And I'd especially value, you know, how you would integrate, Clyde Forshaw, Walter Tobinski, and Haley's brother, Roland, to whom she gave the nickname Raoul, into this scenario, because I know you've given it a lot of thought, Ole.
I have indeed. I just don't know where to start. But if we focus on Walter Tobinski and Clyde and Roland, at this point, I would say that the man that came out of the Cuban embassy in Mexico City, where these photos are taken, that Haley has identified as Walter Tobinski, or Wally as he was also known, this man, according to Haley, is standing right on the corner when the motorcade took this 120 degrees left turn. He's standing about more or less right opposite the sign, the Freeman, the Stemmons Freeway sign. He's standing on the other side of the road, a little bit in on the grass. He's dressed in light clothes, and incredibly enough, he's got a big bulletproof vest, a dark brown bulletproof vest. And it's important to understand that the Zapruder film, even though it's incredible in detail and so on, and really showing a lot, it has been manipulated, and it has been manipulated for a reason. So when you look at when the manipulation starts, that would be a point where I would say, let's check out what happened exactly at that point. And if you see, it is exactly when JFK is hit by the first bullet, that is where the first cut was made, according as far as I can see. And at that point, if you look at the Zapruder film, most people, myself included, have been totally focused on trying to see what was going on in the limo. But up in the right-hand corner, you will see this man. He's almost like a tactical stance with double hand holding of some kind of weapon aimed at the limo. And then as soon as it's fired, he just let his hand drop down by to the sides. Now, if you look at where he was hit and what Haley said that Walter had told her that his task was to fire some kind of tranquilizer at JFK so that he would not be able to move away from the rest of the shooters, so he wouldn't be able to jump down and lay on the floor in the limo and so on. And this is exactly when you see he's slightly starting to turn towards to the left when the first cut is. So if there's a cut and he continues just a little, I mean, we're talking a distance like 2-3 meters from where Walter stands and where the president passed, maybe 5 in total. I mean, it's a turkey shoot when the limo was moving so slow. And the hole that the first place that JFK was hit was just right in the throat under the Adam's apple. And according to I've always thought that was a shot straight from the front. But if we just let's test it out and see if what Haley says could be true. The hole, according to the doctors that saw it, it was only like between 3 and 4 millimeters, a very, very fine hole, and there was no exit hole on the back of in the neck, so it just entered there. According to her, and if you look at what this man is doing, it is exactly what she says. He gets the double up tactical stance, fires something, and lets his hands drop down. And this is when JFK suddenly he raises his hand to his throat, like trying to, well, you know, it's very obvious that he's been hit. So I think there's a very big possibility that is actually what could have happened there. Now,
just to offer, you know, my concerns about that aspect of Haley's story, which you're reconstructing very accurately. Jack had already been hit in the back by a shot fired from the top of the county records building that entered his back about 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column at a downward angle. The shot you're talking about, the hit to his throat, appears to have been the second hit on JFK, though I believe it did come in close proximity to the hit on his back. He is clutching his throat. We actually have a hole in the windshield that aligns perfectly for a shooter at the south end of the Triple Underpass. Doug Weldon, in his brilliant article on the Kennedy limousine published in Murder in Dealey Plaza in the year 2000, reconstructed that. We know there was a through-and-through hole in the windshield. We have a great many witnesses, both at Parkland, but also at Ford Motor Company, including the official who replaced the windshield when it was completely torn down to bare metal and rebuilt on Monday, the 24th, the day of the official, the 25th, the day of the official state funeral. Now, what I find most puzzling about the claim of the, you know, of Walter in that stance, and he does appear to be wearing what certainly looks to me like it could well be a bulletproof vest, is the angle, the trajectory. I don't see how he could have hit Jack in the throat from that angle. You got Nellie Connolly in the way, you got Jackie in the way. I mean, the opportunities for that would have been, you know, virtually, I don't want to say impossible, but very, very narrow window of opportunity with the limousine moving and so forth. I just don't see how that shot could have been made from that location myself, Ole. I mean, I want to hear your take on this. I'm just explaining why this is one of the points on which I have had my own doubts about what Haley had to say, not her sincerity in saying it, not that she doesn't believe it, but whether it's true.
The way I see it, this is not one of Haley's theories, of her own theories. She says this is what Wally told her. And so that's why I listened to it more carefully, because just like you, I've always thought that the hole in the windscreen, that was where the bullet came and hit JFK. I'm just exploring what she has been suggesting. And
yes. Yes, so yes. Far... No, I want you to do that, Ole. Go forward.
It's also that if you look around that area, he's standing right opposite the umbrella man, which I believe was a man by the name of Roy Hargraves, which was closely associated to Operation 40 and one of these mercenaries and soldier of fortunes. Yeah. And that his position was, or his task was just to stand there and show the exact position where everybody should fire, so that it wouldn't be like you wouldn't hear 20 different shots being fired, but everybody would fire at the same time so that one lone patsy could be blamed.
Well, let me just comment on that. We both agree, well, Roy Hargraves, and I believe the so-called Cuban was Felipe Vidal Santiago, who reached out and gives his fist expression, which may or may not have been a signal to William Greer to pull the limousine to the left and do a halt to make sure JFK would be killed. My interpretation of the umbrella is that as long as he's pumping the umbrella, that means the target is still alive. I believe the shot sequence was arranged in 3 salvos, which were supposed to then simulate 3 shots, you know, given the complexity of the acoustics and because there were all the weapons were silenced except for the Mannlicher Carcano out of the Daltex, which was used to fire 3 unsilenced shots. So we may have a difference there. I just want to, you know, clarify where the two of us stand. But I think that, you know, Roy Hargraves was indeed the umbrella man.
I just want to say this, Felipe Vidal Santiago, I totally agree with you. I also believe that that's the identity of this man. He was also very closely associated to Operation 40. And he was later, during many years, working for the CIA, recruiting assassins, both in Africa and many other countries. And He used an alias called Charles Morgan. He was working for a CIA front company called ITT. And the month before the assassination of the Swedish prime minister in the fall of 1985, he was killed in February 86. But in the months before that, a man by the name of Charles Morgan, the exact same Philippe Vidal Santiago, was in Stockholm trying to recruit assassins for the hit on the Swedish prime minister. I mean, we're not talking amateurs here. Again, these are highly skilled and very professional people that have had a long career within this. It started out, I would say many of them almost made like a breakthrough in the assassination field on this day on Dealey Plaza. And through that, as a resume, they've just went skyrocketed in their careers as assassins.
Well, it's fairly stunning, Ole, because I'm inclined to think you're right, that there's a core group of assassins that have been used in multiple killings over and over again. In fact, if you took them out of the picture, if the assassinations for which they were responsible had not occurred, the world would be a totally different place.
Totally, totally. That is why I put such an effort in exposing this, because they're just all over the place. When you look into these assassinations, so many. They're central in the whole Iran-Contra scandal. They were central in taking out Salvador Allende in Argentina. They were central in Operation Condor, where they tracked down and killed Allende supporters. They were doing the Orlando Letier with a car bomb in Washington, D.C., when they blew him up and a woman, an innocent woman by the name of Ronnie Moffitt. They were part of killing Robert Smith in South Africa. They're just again and again and again. You will find these people. They were part of killing Che Guevara in Bolivia. They were part of killing John Lennon. They were part of taking out Bob Marley. You know, it's on and on and on and on.
It's sickening because there were so many good people they killed. So many people who are standing up for the people who wanted to improve the condition of the world, who wanted to promote peace and justice in the world, and they were being killed one after another after another. It's a disgusting history, disgusting. And I think you're right about it, Ole, and I'm just, you know, it's appalling.
Do you know the Committee of 300? It's a group that is said to be even higher up in the power pyramid, in the global power pyramid, above the Triathlon Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderberg Group. There are 300 members there, many of them royalties, but they're Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and so on. And do you know, among them, Bill Gates is one of the other ones, but among those people is a man by the name of Stefano Della Chiaia. Stefano Della Chiaia is one of the, he's called the King of Terror. And he's been so central in so many of these so-called terror acts here in Europe. He's been part of, I don't know how many assassinations, and he was part of the killing of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme in 1986, working together with these other people. And now he's one of the members in this Committee of 300. Can you believe it? It's just like,
I can believe it, but the world is going to have to appreciate and come to grips with the real history that we're talking about. We're going to take our final break. This is Jim Fetzer with my special guest today, Ole Damgaard. We're talking about assassins and assassinations. We'll be right back.
Up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong? Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near. Look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care for all the lonely people? Where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong?
Stem cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
Listener supported. We need your donations to pay for live internet streaming radio, our toll-free call-in number, and our website, free MP3 archive links, and interactive forums. RevereRadioNetwork.com and click on the Make a Donation button.
For people
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, concluding my conversation, but this will not be the last, with Ole Domegaard. Ole, we're talking about the Committee of 300 and talking about the key role of some of the players there and how one of the world's most notorious assassins is a member of the actual committee itself.
It's just, I don't know, I'm just sitting, you know, like, I feel sometimes like my mind is exploding because it's so unreal. But then again, what's the difference between the people ordering the murders and the people carrying them out? I mean, they're still in the same club.
Let me take you back to Dealey Plaza. You were talking about the role of, Walter Tobinski there. Tell us more about the location of the shooters on your analysis and how Clyde Forshaw fits into the scheme of things.
I just want to say that when it comes to Walter Tobinski, you can see him just there's a lot of photos taken just after the shooting in JFK. Sorry, let me just see if I can find the page.
Oh, are you talking about like in Robert Groden's book, The Killing of a President?
Yeah, exactly. I can just say that if you want to see Walter Tobinski and the whole sequence, it's like page 27, 28, and so on. You can see him right there.
Yeah.
And also you can see him in the same book when it's just seconds after the shooting, and he's walking. Oh, I should have found it before. I'm sorry about this.
All right, that's fine.
No, there's just one photo. There's a big bus. I think it's the press bus or something like that. But it's just passing, just a few vehicles after the limo.
Yeah.
And you can see Walter Tobinski walking really relaxed across the street with a big, massive bulletproof vest on. I mean, it's so obvious in that photo. Very relaxed towards the Texas School Book Depository. Because it is... in this assassination, like in so many of these other ones, that people are granted security or whatever you want to call it. You take part of a killing like this and you will get away with murder. You will never be sentenced.
Hey, and they 50 and 51 may have some of these. Yeah, go ahead. So you're saying, yeah, may have been in
No, that is why they're so relaxed with many of these things. Yeah, if you see on page 50... on page 50, you can see on the top right image, there's a car that has stopped and somebody is trying to get out of the car.
Yeah.
Can you see the Okay,
left, yeah.
right behind the car, you will see this guy with a bulletproof vest just walk towards the school book depository.
Yeah.
Can you see him?
Yeah, I do. And this again is in Robert Groden's The Killing of a President, for those who have the volume at hand. Continue, Ole. Tell me more about how you believe that Clyde fits into this scheme.
Okay, Clyde instead is standing, according to Haley, he was standing right behind where Abraham Zapruder was. And you will see that, I would say that if you see page 57, I'm sorry, I should have...
No, that's fine. I'm looking at 57.
Okay, yeah, but if you could maybe edit these minutes out just before I find it.
No, photo. That's okay. No, we're okay. she had told me that he was Black Dog Man, which will fit into previous analyses of the photographic scenario.
No, I would say that is not correct.
All right.
Okay, if you look at page 193.
193?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, the top photo, you will see that there's an arrow where Black Dog Man is positioned, yeah?
Yes.
Can you see that? But if you see to the right on that photo, can you see there's actually a car that has been reversed up against the wall, and there's a shooter next to it.
Yeah.
With his hand on. That is Clyde, as far as I understand. That is Clyde. And you will see that as soon as the shots are fired, this car disappears. It drives out, and then on.
And I think, according to Haley, that car then would be driven by her brother.
Exactly. So
Roland Otis, also known as Rayol.
Yeah, and if you go to page 57, you go to page 57.
Yeah.
Up in the top right corner.
Yes.
That is Clyde. The car is just, Roland is driving the car out into the parking, and that is Clyde up in the right-hand corner. The same clothing, like he is in the other photo where he's shooting. And you will see, I think that if you look at the left corner, in the darker clothes there, that is possibly the badge man or black dog. Because Gordon Arnold, who was standing right behind these two when the shots were fired, he was standing in front of the picket fence, but behind the wall. Gordon Arnold was this man in uniform, a youngster who was just standing there filming, not understanding what was going on. And he said that one shots were fired right out above him, yeah, right to the by his ear. And he just jumped down. And then when he looked up again, a police officer was standing there with a gun pointed at his head, just say, "Did you film it? Did you film it?" And he just gave over the film. And then the police officer disappeared. So if you
they were surveying witnesses in Dealey Plaza and taking photographs and films, you know, and of course, and the FBI agents were stationed at the photo processing labs in Dallas for 2 weeks after the assassination to gather up any photos or films related to the shooting.
Yeah, but I think that
not to solve the crime, mind you, but of course to cover up the evidence.
Yeah, exactly. But if you see in the top left corner, where he left a Coca-Cola bottle on the wall, I think that is Black Dog or Badge Man, who is more or less facing Gordon Arnold, who's lying down. And then, because when you see the enlargement of Badge Man, next to him, there's a railroad worker standing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you see right in the middle of the page, there's on the right-hand side, on the bottom of that page, there's a light-colored, a man dressed in light color. That could be the railroad worker.
Are you on page 56, 57, or another page?
57.
Yeah, 57, okay.
That could be the railroad worker. So we got these two. So, and I would say, according to me, Badge Man or Black Dog, either he's Lucien Sarti, who was an assassin that was supplied by Santos Traficante, but from Marseille in France, and brought in from New Mexico and then in through over the border in Brownsville and driven up to Dallas. Either it's him or Roscoe White. I'm not sure who. I haven't been able to figure that one out, and I've never been able to figure out the identity of the railroad worker either. But in this picture on 57, 50, 56, 57, I think this is exactly when you see Clyde is following the car that Roland is driving out.
Yeah.
Walter Tobinski is at the same time is crossing the street, walking towards the Texas School Book Depository. And the actual shooter that fired the final headshot was behind the picket fence. And this is, according to me, the man, James Files, that I know we don't agree upon. But I would very much like to, in great detail, go in around this person because he is super interesting, I would say.
I think we should do that on a subsequent show, Ole.
I think so too.
We'll talk in great detail about James Files and why you believe he was that shooter and I do not. Whereas I believe, in fact, this shot that entered the right temple with a frangible or exploding bullet was fired by Frank Sturgis from the north end of the Triple Underpass, where the picket fence and the Triple Underpass come together. But let me just say a few remarks about the difference physically between Walter Tobinski and Clyde. Clyde's actually very short. He's about 5'4". He wears built-up shoes to make himself appear taller, and he has a ruddy complexion. There are multiple photographs you can find of Clyde as the Walter or Geezer Bandit in Bank Robbers and Serial Killers. And Haley directed me to yet another photograph, which may be the most clear photograph I've seen of Clyde, although his face is partially obscured. He has very intelligent eyes. I was struck by this, Ole. I mean, the man is, you know, he hasn't got away with all these murders by being stupid. He's very clever. He's very shrewd. He targets, you know, he sees as also, you know, targets opportunity. She's described me how they'd be driving along the road and there'd be some woman, you know, walking along defenseless, and Clyde would say, oh, I got to go back. And then he wants to murder her just because she's vulnerable and, you know, that she shouldn't have made herself vulnerable. I mean, he's such a predator that he will murder people just for the sake of killing them. I mean, for no good reason whatsoever.
Yeah. Also, I would say that I've got a theory that just like Haley suggests, because what she says is that Clyde told her that it was actually Clyde who shot Officer J.D. Tippit. And when you, but there, I believe that there were two shooters, just like Clemens, one of this black woman who,
yes.
Exactly, she saw that there were two shooters and they ran in different directions. That is also why the different witnesses, they described them very differently.
And different caliber shell casings, both from automatics, but two Remington ran and two Western.
Yeah, but James Files, I'm coming back to him later, but he was, after the shooting, he was hiding at the Lamplighter Motel in Mesquite, just outside Dallas. And he had just showered, he had waxed his whole body to get rid of powder residue and so on, so they couldn't be tracked down. And suddenly somebody knocked on the door. Like I said before, his controller was David Attlee Phillips, who was very central in this assassination. He was the only one, except for Chucky Nicoletti, a CIA mob guy who was working very closely with James Files, who was also taking part of the assassination. They were the only two that knew that James Files were there, as far as he knew. Then somebody knocked on the door, and he opens up, and it's an old acquaintance of his by the name of Gary Marlowe, who is quite a tall guy, and he said, "My God, I just had to kill a cop. Please take the gun." And he had a revolver, and James Fowler was, I mean, he had just been part of a major crime, and he just said, "Absolutely no way, get out of here." So he more or less pushed this guy out and closed the door again, you know, because the last thing he wanted was to lose the cover. And also, he was so amazed and surprised by how this man knew that he was there, meaning that the only one that could have informed him would, in my opinion, would be David Attlee Phillips. Now, David Attlee Phillips was famous of having backups whenever they carried out an assassination or a thing like this. He had multiple players, passive ones, you know, on standby. Whatever should occur or would occur, he would have an option. And I believe that what happened this day was that Lee Harvey Oswald was not meant to get away. And they were looking for him. J.D. Tippit, I think Clyde, Walter, all of these guys were driving around looking for Lee Harvey Oswald, trying to eliminate him before he would start revealing what was actually going on. And I believe possibly that Roland... that this car with Roland, Walter, possibly Gary Marlowe, and Walter Tobinski, that they were driving near on Patton and so on 10th Street, and that they had just stopped and dropped, that he had dropped off the two, Gary Marlowe and Clyde, and then J.D. Tippit came up in the patrol car, noticed these two guys, and also it is said that Clyde was almost a lookalike of Lee Harvey Oswald, so there could have been a misinterpretation of identity, and that was the reason why J.D. Tippit stopped, because J.D. Tippit was observed just the minutes before when he was killed, that he was driving up, he was behaving very, very agitated, and he pulled over a car, ran back to the car, checked out if there anybody was hiding in the back seat, didn't say a word, ran back into the car, drove off again. So he was really looking for someone. That's quite obvious. And it seems like when you, for some reason, I do not know why the shooting started, but it seems like both Clyde and Gary Marlowe fired shots at this police, killed him. And that also when you hear Helen Markham's testimony, when she describes the assassin, she says he's very...
Don't you mean Aquila Clemens?
No, Aquila Clemens. She said there are two shooters.
Right, neither of them look like Lee Oswald.
Exactly. One was thin and quite tall, which would fit in for Gary Marlowe. And the other one was short. She said she was short, almost a bit stubby. The shortness would fit in very well, and also the way the colors of the clothes that she describes, that fits in if you check with the colors of this photo on Dealey Plaza. That also Helen Markham that saw she faced the actual assassin. She said that she was short and with a ruddy complexion, which fits spot on when it comes to Clyde.
Yes.
So I think there's a great possibility that if we listen to Haley, the story fits, and then one of the shooters would be Clyde, and the other one I would suggest would be Gary Marlowe, because as far as I know, there were no other police officers shot this day, and this guy claims to have done it.
There is a rumor of a Secret Service agent having been shot and killed, but I've never been able to substantiate it.
No, neither have I. But also what Haley also says, that Clyde and Walter was later part of, they were the ones who killed Buddy Walters, the Dallas police that found a bullet. They were also the ones that took out this poor guy, Roger Craig, incredibly brave former Dallas police officer as well, that the only thing that he did was to stand up and say what was true. That there were more than one.
Well, he described seeing someone he thought was Lee Oswald run down and get into a station wagon in front of the book depository. Yeah. And there's been a lot of dispute about the station wagon, though Haley's very specific about it. Would you comment on that?
I think she's wrong, though. I believe that... I think that it was Ruth Payne's Nash Rambler that was doing that. I think the driver was David Morales, part of the Operation 40. He was very high up in Operation 40. And he was also at the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was killed. He was also the guy that, on the order of Felix Rodriguez from Operation 40, were the one that actually murdered Che Guevara in Bolivia. I think he was the driver. And if you look... when you enlarge different photos, the Albion photo and so on, you will see that somebody that resembles David de Morales a lot he's hanging on one of the telephone poles looking, and he resembles
James
a lot.
You mean at the corner of Houston and Maine?
Yeah.
James
exactly.
Richard corrected me on that and said it wasn't Morales, but a guy named Pishini, as I recall, who looked a lot like him, but that's not Morales on the... Morales could have been driving the car. Haley said it was a turquoise and white Chevy, and I believe that Ruth Payne, in fact, had a turquoise and white Chevy. But no. I think that you may be right that it was actually the Nash Rambler. The odd thing is that Lee Oswald, during his interrogation, said, "Don't bring her in this. Ruth Payne had nothing to do with it," which is a very odd remark. Go ahead on that.
No, I think Haley is misunderstanding here, because I do think that the Plymouth that she's talking about was there that day for sure. I think that is the one that was reversed in towards the wall that we just described.
Required shooting, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it was a witness by the name of Richard Carr was on a building, on top of a building on the other side of Dealey Plaza, looking down over Dealey Plaza, and he saw that a Nash Rambler was parked on the wrong side of the street, on Houston Street, right on the corner of the Texas School Book Depository, which is exactly where you see this guy on the telephone pole, which I really think that is the David Morales. And he saw that there were four people running towards this car from behind Texas School Book Depository, and three of them jumped into this car and took off going north on Houston Street. I think that's the same car that who I believe is David Morales, dropped off the other two, came back and picked up if it was Clyde or if it was Lee Harvey, I don't know, but that's the same car coming back. But very important, I do not agree with you that it was Malcolm Wallace that was up down the shooter on the sixth floor up there, of one of them. Because if you look at he never committed any... I mean, the murders he was involved in was mostly with the monoxide or different poisons. There was, and if there were violence involved, it was very sloppy. He was not a very good shot, as far as I know. The guy that has been pointing out was a man by the name of Richard Kane, a former police officer from Chicago that then became a lieutenant under Sam Giancana of Chicago. And according to sources that I believe, Sam Giancana was actually staying at the Adolphus Hotel this day, together with Richard Kane. And Richard Kane was wearing the same type of glasses as Malcolm Wallace, very horn-rimmed, big glasses. And what witnesses saw was that the fourth guy that didn't jump into the car, he ran down Houston Street and then down, turned the corner and went down Commerce Street. And this is exactly, you only go like 200 meters down the street and you come to Adolphus Hotel where Giancana and Richard Kane were staying. That's also right opposite the Carousel Club that Jack Ruby had.
Ole, I'm so, not... I have enormous respect for your research, and I'm perfectly prepared to be shown to be wrong about aspects of my own analysis, because I think it's more important than who makes these determinations that we should get it right. And therefore, I so value your collaboration in all of this. I want to just express our mutual concern that everyone, the whole public, should know what's going on here, that Haley has been threatened, that many people are surprised she's still alive. She's been doing her best to get the truth out about these crimes, and that when she conveyed her threat to, you know, to me, that there was the risk to me and my family, I think she was being utterly sincere about that. And in my opinion now, there's no longer any point in not discussing this publicly, because the more people who know, the better. Ole and I and the members of our family are not about to do ourselves in. If something untoward should happen to any of us, I want more people to know who was very likely to have been responsible for this act. I'm shocked that the Toronto Police and the Canadian Royal Mounted Police and the FBI and even the U.S. Attorney right here in Madison have been unwilling to do anything about this. I find that utterly shocking. I encourage everyone to go and reread read the article if you haven't read it before, Bank Robbers and Serial Killers, because, you know, there are quite a few interviews I've done previously with Haley. Clyde and Walter and so forth know that Haley has been talking to me, obviously. I even received a comment from Alfred, Clyde's son, who is the attorney, saying that that Haley used to be Clyde's girlfriend and that she was crazy, and that if I wanted to believe what she said, that was okay with him. But, you know, there it was. So I want everyone to become aware of this, because as Ole and I are suggesting, Haley may be providing some missing pieces to a number of assassinations. And from the larger point of view, as Ole has been describing, we may be talking about one of the most important assassination rings in world history, responsible or complicit in a multiplicity of the deaths of very important figures in world history. Ole, further thoughts from you before we conclude for today?
I just want to say that Haley deserves all respect and honor. And I mean, if I've ever seen a hero, she is one incredible human being that has been standing up for this. And it's just, it's so awful that nobody has listened to us, because she has so detailed information. And also, I just want to say also that these recorded conversations that you had with her, I have done my utmost, and many other people have just spread it all over the world to multiple places, so that this information will not be stopped or will not be revealed, whatever happens. So
be lost, whatever happens. Right. It'll be available, be made public by multiple sources all over the world. Ole, I can't thank you enough. I think you do absolutely magnificent research, and I'm very much looking forward to having you back again as my guest. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest today, Ole Domegaard, for being here, and all of you for listening.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.